Welcome to The Foundry, the podcast where we talk to students, local and not local entrepreneurs across the Midwest to bring you stories and insights that you can use to start your own path within UW-Madison's startup community. Today, I'm joined by Sam Rockwell, CEO of Happy Co. He's been innovating in the market for almost 16 years now, from his early beginnings in his company, Waffle Waffle, where he created an on-the-go twist on Belgian waffles, to his latest creations and collaborations with big-name celebrities like Snoop Dogg and Dave Portnoy. And finally, he's once again teamed up with his former roommates, Jeremy Reich and Justin Samuels, to make Laughing Tiger, a flavorful noodle meal in the convenient and accessible packaging of frozen food. Sam Rockwell, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Doing great. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Of course. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving for our viewers. We're recording this on December 1st, so, you know, just coming off that holiday.
You as well, and to everybody listening and watching, hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving as well. And I hope you stock your freezers ahead of the holiday with some great Happy Co. products.
Yeah. So I just want to start this off kind of going back to, like, your beginnings. So, you know, like, getting close to Waffle Waffle, you know, you started back at, like, the Mifflin Street block party, where you kind of turned a party, environment into a market. And, you know, take us back to the moment where you handed over that first waffle. And, like, what was the specific, like, realization that you had in that environment that kind of pushed you to kind of go towards this career path?
Yeah, so I think that the biggest realization I got out of the Mifflin Street block party is that I didn't want to sell waffles to drunk people, first and foremost. And I didn't want to sell waffle products in a retail setting, more seriously. And I think the reason being is because you learn in the most simplistic way that when you have a brick and mortar, and there's no discounting how effective of a business plan it can ultimately be. But given I was a 21-year-old kid with an undergraduate education in business, which really does teach you how to read, but it doesn't necessarily give you the understanding of the ins and outs of business, because that comes with experience. And having very little resources to my name, dollars specifically, you realize that opening up a brick and mortar just for the right to cut the ribbon, it's the better portion of $500,000 to $1 million. And that's before you even begin or sell a single unit, a single waffle, a single product. And so as I did some very rough math, it's like, well, I need the better part of $500,000 to $1 million just for the right to cut the ribbon. Don't know where I'm going to get that. And then once I do that, how many waffles do we have to sell a year to break even? Okay, well, how many waffles do we have to sell a month to break even? Okay, well, let's break that down even more. How many waffles do we have to sell a week or a day or an hour? And for me, I felt as if the road at that point in my life to profitability was too long. And so having limited resources, but a lot of energy and belief in what we were doing, we decided to try and take a more organic and variable cost approach to building this business. And instead of opening up a restaurant and creating an experience, we wanted to help other restaurants or retailers to create or build out a waffle experience for their customers. And that's ultimately how we started to produce and to distribute and sell these Belgian style waffles into existing footprint restaurants and QSRs, as well as the retailers, the grocery stores. And the business then was built kind of off of that simplistic business model.
Right. Okay. That's really interesting. And kind of like connecting to what you're saying, like not having a lot of dollars to your name, you graduated in 2010, which was correct, not so long after the financial crash. So how much of that choice was like driven by like passion versus like just thinking about, is this a safe like corporate option around this time?
Yeah, that's definitely was a factor in it. And I was of the mindset that I'm a very competitive person, and I will always bet on myself to win. And so if that was to get a job for a different company and for working for somebody else, I would bet on myself. That being said, if I'm going to bet on myself in a very difficult environment to go out and get a job, I want to build a floor, not a ceiling. So all of the work that I do, I'd rather put into building something that's special, that's long lasting, that's untapped in terms of potential. And so like 2009, 2010, if you go to Granger School of Business, there's a bunch of kids holding Financial Times to impress recruiters. And I'm like, that's just not me. And while, again, I would bet on myself to get the job over anybody else, if I'm going to do that, why don't I bet on myself to build a career, to build a brand, to create value that has no limit? And so at that point in time, I felt that given my life as a 21, 22-year-old just graduating from UW, I had a better opportunity to grow and excel with limited downside. And so I figured that was the right time.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, kind of what you just said, like you've said that before with, you know, betting on yourself and building a floor and not a ceiling. What did it actually look like, you know, as being a 21 and a 22-year-old, like in the first 12 months of really trying to like hit that marker and try to build something meaningful, like going into the nitty gritty details of actually like living, like how did that work?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, I have to thank my family because they were incredibly supportive of this journey, this decision that I made. Because if I didn't have the support of my family coming out of school, they were like, hey, you can stay at home. You can live at home. We're going to give you dinner at the end of the day. But as a result of that, I was able to go out during the work hours and put all of my heart and soul into this business and trying to figure it out. And it wasn't a linear path. It wasn't a straight line. There was no like silver bullet or, you know, golden moment, if you will. It was really just trying to understand the commercial manufacturing, ultimately distribution business and consumer products. And that was a slow build. And our journey began, of course, as we just mentioned before, at the Mifflin Street Block Party. But from there, it grew and adapted into let's try and sell these products, as I mentioned before, into retail and to wholesale. And by doing that, you learn, well, now we're not selling a waffle for $10 a piece. We're selling a waffle for 50 cents. And so we have to sell a heck of a lot more products in a given period of time in order to move the needle. But we don't have as much fixed overhead. And so in doing that, we're like, okay, what's the best way to scale this business? First and foremost, let's identify if people like the product. And so we rented space out of a Dunkin' Donuts commissary. They were tasked with, I guess, producing all of the donuts for the New York City small footprint Dunkin' Donuts locations, and they would make donuts overnight. And at 5 a.m, they would ship the donuts out to the various locations around the New York metro area. And Justin, co-founder, and I would go in around 6 a.m. to this Dunkin' Donuts commissary and use a certified facility. It was a certified facility, but we had no expertise in what, you know, safety and sanitary regulations and requirements were needed. We just knew that they adhered to them. So we would go in during their downtime while they were cleaning their donut lines, and we would bring waffle irons and make as many waffles during the time allotted to us as possible, which was from 6 a.m. to about 11 a.m. At 11 a.m, it was time to start making donuts again for the next day. And they're like, hey, you guys got to get out of here. And what we would do is we'd pack up and we'd take however many waffles we made in that day, which was about 150 to 200, split them in half. Justin would go left, I would go right, and whoever came back with a fewer waffles at the end of the day was the self-proclaimed winner. and this was not, it was not glamorous by any means. It was a difficult journey. And best case scenario, you sell every single waffle you made. I also saw it as worst case scenario as well, because that meant the next day we had to get up at 5 a.m. and go make waffles again. So it was a grind. And what we learned in that, as I kind of mentioned before, is that you need to sell an awful lot of product in order to move the needle in the business path that we've chosen. Selling 200 waffles a day is not going to cut it. So how do we scale this business so that we could sell 2,000 waffles in a day, 20,000 waffles in a day, 200,000 waffles in a day or in a week? And we really put in, I would say, the time, the energy, the sweat to try and build out a small base of customers. And working with restaurants was great. We learned that people really liked the product, but we also recognized that by selling to restaurants, we weren't getting any credit for the work that we were doing outside of them buying the product from us. And so we needed to not only build scale and volume, but we needed to think about brand, because brand was a way that we could connect with consumers directly. So as we innovated and created additional product lines, we could talk to consumers and ultimately pull demand or get our products into retail by pulled demand. at this time, we were in like the 2011, 2012 time frame. And Whole Foods Market was incredibly decentralized at that time. This is prior to Amazon acquiring them. Each store had a local forager, somebody that could bring in or identify and bring in a local supplier, a company or brand that was local to a region. And at that point in time, we felt as if the Whole Foods customer would be a great customer for our brand. And so we started to go into the Whole Foods locally. Justin and I and Jeremy are all from the New York metro area. So we'd go to some Whole Foods in the New York metro area. And we got into a single Whole Foods, which was in the Upper West Side, New York City. We would go in, we'd make breakfast for the employees without having product on the shelf to try and find that local forager in each of the locations. And finally, the ball dropped, the shoe dropped, and we were able to get into that one single store, And that kind of unlocked us to get into additional retailers, more Whole Foods, because if we were in one, we were approved in all for that region, and that really helped. And then two, specifically back in 2011, 2012, and I still think today, when you're a supplier to Whole Foods, it means something to other retailers. And so by doing that, we would go to the other retailers and say, we're a supplier to Whole Foods. And we weren't lying. We were a supplier to Whole Foods. It was one single store, but again, we weren't lying. And one store led to another, to another, to another. And we were able to start to build out the base of customers and retailers that we serviced. And ultimately, that's how we scaled the business. And we went from making 200 waffles a day to getting a commissary kitchen in the Bronx in New York City and making 500 waffles a day. Then added more waffle irons and more people and made 1,000 waffles a day. And then we made 2,000 waffles in a day and we were able to sell all of those. And then finally, we had to make decisions to invest in infrastructure to not only increase our output per day, but to reduce the cost per unit. And so we went from making 2,000 waffles a day to investing in a manufacturing line that made 2,000 waffles in an hour. And then from 2,000 waffles an hour, we were able to scale the business and have a modest margin improvements and then reinvest the business to have another line where we made 7,000 waffles in an hour. And that's how we were able to scale and grow our business over a 4 or 5 year period, which again, it was an organic growth story. It was a scrappy, grinded out story, but recognition that keep your overhead relatively low, keep your costs variable, and always work to improve your sales and reduce your cost to ultimately improve your margin. And whatever margin you're able to squeeze out, how can we reinvest in the infrastructure to scale the business up?
Wow, that's actually just like very cool to hear. And, you know, kind of laying out the gas of just like kind of pressuring you about a lot of business. Is there like, do you think that you kind of have a fascination with like food? Like, you know, you've gone very far in like into this business model of different types of like food. Besides just the business, is there kind of a personal interest in a like attachment that you have?
I don't have any experience in or technical expertise in food science, but I'm a great consumer. I can eat with the best of them. And so something I understood from a consumption standpoint, which is what I think drew me into this side of the world, this business. Unlike you, Ben, which you're an engineer. So you will have a specific technical know-how and knowledge. Food science, same thing. Again, for me, I gravitated towards the commercial aspect of the things I enjoyed as a consumer, which is ultimately what brought me to the food world. And then if you think about it, like people need to eat. In the best of times and the worst of times, people will continue to eat. There are certain, I think, industries in the business sector that ebb and flow based on economic conditions and the external climate. Here, again, people always come back to, we need to eat breakfast, we need to eat lunch, we need to eat dinner. And so we've tried to build off of that. And as we've grown, we've reinvested in infrastructure and capabilities to expand outside of the waffle iron and offer more products for more day parts for more consumers. And that's ultimately what's led to the growth of the business and these other brands that we've grown and built from the ground up.
Right. Yeah. And kind of going back to what you were talking about, you know, the early days of going with going in that Dunkin' Donuts commissary and being with your roommates, you started this with Justin Samuels and Jeremy Reich. And a lot of founders have warned about, you know, starting businesses with best friends and close people that you know. Like, mm-hmm. How do you feel like you've created this strong structure to kind of actually go against this warning of, like, starting a business with your friends?
It's a fair warning. And the way that I look at it is that you make decisions to become family members, to be brothers. And what do? We argue at times. We have disagreements, but it's how we resolve those disagreements and move forward, which I give, this would not be a thing today if both Jeremy, Justin, and even the others within our company, but specifically Jeremy and Justin, couldn't compartmentalize the fact that this is business and not friendship. And that there are disagreements, and how do we work through that and communicate through each other's point of view and why and get to a better place. And then I would say most importantly, it's separation of responsibilities and accountability. I am responsible for something that Jeremy is not responsible for. He is responsible for something that I nor Justin are responsible for. And the same holds true for Justin. So we each own our own vertical or channel or area within the business. Now, at the end of the day, we're all responsible for the growth and success of the business, but we each own and lead a different sector. And I think that's a really important part, because then it's like, this is my domain. Let me explain to you what I'm doing and why. And at the end of the day, I'm responsible to you for a specific result. And if I'm not delivering on that result, that's on me. If I am, that's also me. And I think that's a way to try and work through it, but it does take tough conversations and being able to have those with one another, understanding that no individual is bigger than the business. The business is bigger than us. And last, but certainly not least, I would say true accountability and scrappiness and alignment on goals.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it ain't easy. I'll tell you that. It ain't easy, and it's not for everybody. But we've been able to have those hard conversations and keep moving the next day as if nothing happened. And also, I think, separate our friendship from the business. And we're able to leave work and go have dinner together as friends and then get back to work and be business partners.
Right. Yeah. And kind of more of a simple question. I've, you know, been able to have the privilege to interview some other entrepreneurs. And a lot of them kind of talk about how, you know, they've also started businesses with a startup at UW-Madison. And usually now their business has evolved into something that, like, they've accidentally stumbled upon. Do you feel like that you've kind of, it's only been evolution, and like you've kind of gone through and through like the original path that you've saw yourself kind of going down? Or do you also feel like you were kind of going down a path and then suddenly you kind of struck gold with something else and you branched off to that path?
I don't think that there's ever been any gold strikes per se. I think there's been lessons and evolutions and adjustments throughout the entire story of HappyCo. You know, we started as a waffle business because we believed in a product that was underrepresented in the marketplace. I still feel that way about that product. As you get into this business and learn more, you're able to identify the opportunities in the white space and understand what consumers are looking for, I believe, as well as what retailers are seeking. And if we have the right infrastructure and we have the right relationships, we're able to capture, I think, some of those opportunities and exploit that white space, which is what lead you from waffles to pizza, from pizza to ice cream to snacks and appetizers and ultimately meals. And so the reinvestment in our infrastructure is a direct result of what we saw the consumers demanding as well as what the retailers were looking for.
Right. And I remember earlier you were talking about how, you know, once you were selling to restaurants, you really realized that, like, you know, that branding is a really important part that you wanted to focus on. And how did you transition from kind of, you know, doing Waffle at first, where it was more like a product focused thing, to building like Happy Co, where now you've kind of become like a house of brands and you've had big partnerships with, like, you know, Snoop Dogg and Dave Portnoy?
Mm-hmm. So as we were growing and we became a trusted, viable supplier to the biggest retailers in the world, Walmart, Costco, Whole Foods, so on and so forth, we had a unique perspective because we had a seat at the table in an industry, specifically frozen food, with very few players. Huge players, but very few players. Conagra, CJ Foods, Kraft Heinz, Unilever, Nestle, the biggest players in the world. And these guys, there's, you know, 8 to 10 of them, own about 90% of the brands in the space. So the average consumer will walk down the aisle and in ice cream say, one person may say, I want Ben and Jerry's. The other person may say, well, I want Talenti. That's the same company. That's Unilever, which is now Magnum Ice Cream Company. And so as a result, the retailers are incredibly over-leveraged by the big guys. Now, what the big guys have is they've got scale, they've got brands, they've got food science, R&D, but they also have huge wallets for marketing spend. What do we have? We have grit, determination, we're fast, we're flexible, and we're partnership oriented. I can listen to what the retailers' gripes are, what their grievances are, what the white space is, and how they need to deleverage themselves from the big guys. What I can't do is I can't pay for a billboard at Times Square. I can't rename Camp Randall Stadium after us. But I think what we're able to do, which is different, is be early. We were early adopters, and I think we continue to be leaders in this space of creator-led brands, specifically in frozen. The big guys can go pay creators and celebrities a couple $1 million to smile and say cheese and to have a campaign or to have some sort of endorsement with them, but they can't ever partner with the creator in the way that we can. They can't have the creator put skin in the game and influence the product and the brand the way that we can. And so as you got to 2018, 2019, and 2020, you kind of had the rise of social media and the introduction of these people, which now those people that we call influencers have reach and have the ability to affect consumer habits and behaviors, ultimately purchasing. And so we were, again, really early adopters into this idea that if you take the right creator with the right audience and authenticity and tie that person or that group or that brand to a product that ultimately fits into their world, and authenticity is key, as I've just mentioned before, and that's something that I'll continue to mention, there's an opportunity to drive new traffic into a relatively dusty and boring space. And we were able to prove that with Dave Portnoy and with Barstool Sports and developing One Bite Pizza. Like, that thesis was proven to be true. And when we launched Barstool's Pizza, over 75% of the consumers of One Bite were new to a category that hadn't recruited a new consumer in the past, you know, 5 to 10 years. So it was somewhat game changing and set, I think, the tone, the game plan, and the strategy for the next, you know, handful of years for us as we look to build out, develop, and curate brands and products.
Right. And during COVID, when David Portnoy was reviewing frozen pizzas, you kind of saw that opportunity to pounce and were able to launch what you just mentioned, One Bite. How did you actually, like, how were you able to specifically pitch that to him and connect with him and try to get this product kind of launched and whatnot?
Well, I actually connected with Dave and Barstool prior to the pandemic. And so what I was looking at, again, which categories, specifically within the frozen section, are dusty, stale, lack innovation, and need something that's going to make some noise, exploit the white space. For us, we were looking at that time at frozen pizza. It was a growing category. 90% of that space was dominated by a couple brands and a couple companies, Schwann's, Nestle, for the most part. And I was trying to think through, how do we break through? You know, Dave built a cult following in what he did as a media personality. And a lot of that was based upon his pizza reviews, going to different places around the country, reviewing pizzas. And he became the authority for, I know what good pizza is and I know where you can get it. My whole thought process or thesis is, not only does he understand the best in pizza, but he knows where to get it. Why don't we bring the best in pizza to people, which creates access? He's authentic. Let's create access and let's build this thing out. And so kind of shared with him our thoughts into the space and where the opportunity was. And honestly, at the time, he's like, I don't really eat frozen pizza. Fast forward a few months, because that was late 2019, early 2020, the world shuts down. He starts to review frozen pizzas. We get a phone call saying, how'd you guys know this was going to happen? Well, I didn't know it was going to happen. But when the world is disrupted by a pandemic, 5 years of trends kind of is condensed into 2 weeks, if you will. And mm-hmm. So at that moment in time, we decided to partner together and build out One Bite in the frozen pizza category. And we were able to, I think, really prove to the marketplace, but specifically the retailers, that if you do something with somebody who has authenticity and reach, and you create a product that is accessible, you can drive new consumers into a category and move the needle.
Right. And how is that with Snoop Dogg? You know, like, how did you connect with him to make a ice cream brand, you know?
So he is I would say he's one of these, the ultimate. He is, without using all of his terms, but he's the OG influencer. He has found a way to not only reinvent himself, but have a direct connection with people of all different races, ages, income brackets, and demographics over 3+ decades. And I think part of what has helped him to do that is that he is the uninfluenced influencer. He has stood for what he's stood for 3 decades, and that has just become more and more accepted. And so, like, again, it goes back to, what are the categories that are dusty and ripe for disruption? What are the categories we feel that we have the infrastructure and ability to create products and disrupt? And for us, that, again, fit into this window of ice cream. 95% of the ice cream space is chocolate, vanilla, or caramel. And there's very little innovation within the fruit-forward SKUs. Over 90% of the brands within the ice cream category fall under the umbrella of 2 to 3 giant behemoth companies. And so, again, white space, opportunity to disrupt, retailers are over-leveraged. I think there's an under-indexed consumer who's not being thought about. In order to do all this disruption, we need to reach people. We need to have that, like, authentic touch to it. And that's where we thought through, who are some good, viable partners in the space? And, you know, Snoop Dogg, top of the list, I would say, because of his authenticity, because of his personality, because of what he stands for, because he's America's uncle. And we happened to, through, you know, our network, reach out for Snoop. Snoop, serendipitously at the same time, was looking to be an entrepreneur, to get out of being the face of a brand that is a paid to smile, say cheese, and that's the end of it, but instead to be a curator of a brand, the co-founder of a company, and build something that he has an influence and day-to-day connection to in what the product and the brand are. And those two things together, again, serendipitously led us to Snoop and Snoop to us, and we aligned on trying to build a business. And what I told Snoop at the time when I met him, it was the first time we ever met him. We went to his studio in LA, and we brought some of our, you know, out of the cupboard recipes to show him what our capabilities were. And when he came in, we started trying different things and talking about building a business together. And there was probably 30, 40 people in the room, and it's me and him talking. He's trying some ice creams, trying different things. And he's like, this is good. We can make this better. Let's do this. Of course, you know, I was very supportive of that and on board. And what I asked him is I said, "Hey, Snoop, I got a question for you." I said, "Can you make decisions for yourself?" And he looked at me like I was crazy. He's like, "What do you mean, can I make decisions for myself? I'm the boss of myself." I said, "Great, because you know, us, me, Jeremy, and Justin, we can make the decisions for our business to be partners with you. I want to make sure you can make the decision to be partners with us, and that the people standing around you, all 40 of these people watching, don't have an effect on it, because those are the guys that are going to mess it up. If we're going to be partners, there's going to be hard conversations. But at the end of the day, you and me, meaning Jeremy, Justin, myself, we're going to make the decisions together as partners." And at that moment in time, he stuck it at his hand, shook our hands, and was like, "Let's roll." And all of the paper that's gone into building out our business has been right in line with what we shook our hands on. And so he's been a great partner ever since. And Dr. Bombay Ice Cream is a brand that he is truly a co-founder of, and curated the brand and thought through the flavors, and ultimately how we call Dr. Bombay hip hop style ice cream. Hip hop is infiltrated culture in music. It's a blend of sounds and rhythms. It's infiltrated culture in fashion, different fabrics, different colors, things of that nature. I think that Dr. Bombay Ice Cream is the first time hip hop has infiltrated food. We have ice cream and sherbet blends. We've got different flavor combinations of orange and vanilla, of peanut butter and jelly, of blueberry muffin, of Long Beach fruit cart, of sticky caramel apple. It's a very unique combination. And I think it's cut through. And it also is indicative of Snoop Dogg. He's a very unique person. He thinks very uniquely. He's super duper creative. And it just lends itself to the white space and the opportunity and the true, I think, perfect idea of curation of a brand from a creator or celebrity.
Right. I really like your focus on like authenticity in food and like products. Have you ever like been interested in, you know, maybe moving towards like a restaurant, or do you feel like that your interest is in the domain of like frozen food products? And is there money to be made in restaurants, or is that like, or is supermarkets and all that kind of thing like the place to go?
We definitely want to build our brand that's accessible to all, which I think is going to traditional grocery channels and the mass market like Walmart, convenience stores like 7-Eleven. That being said, with Dr. Bombay, I think it's a unique circumstance where having a flagship location may be a good idea. And we're actually working on that plan with Snoop to build one out in California, in Los Angeles. It's a testing ground for flavors. As I think you guys have talked about, in case you don't know, our lead developer for products in Dr. Bombay is Dr. Maya Warren. She graduated with a PhD in food science, specifically in ice cream, from the University of Wisconsin. And so we're really, really grateful and proud to have her leading our product development. But this location in Los Angeles is actually going to be almost like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory, for Snoop Dogg and for Dr. Maya, a place where they can go to create different flavors and to test them with consumers. And it's a place where Snoop will be able to go to try ice cream, and fans, customers of the brand can go to try the latest and greatest, or to have a little bit of a experience within the brand for a particular point in time if they're in the Los Angeles area. And then after that, you can go to your local Walmart or 7-Eleven and grab some of our products and enjoy them on an everyday basis. Whether or not the business plan works with it, I mean, I'm a believer in it because it's a small footprint, highly innovative, and I think Instagram worthy location that it's going to be. That being said, we're also utilizing it as an R&D facility and a test lab. So it really like folds into the existing business as well.
Right. I really appreciate, the in-depth level that you've gone about your business and your beginnings and all of this. So we can begin to kind of wrap this up, but I just have some kind of like some lightning round questions, if you don't mind.
Yeah, for sure.
What was your favorite food here at UW-Madison?
Cheese curds. There's no question.
Right. And
that's not something that's not something that I tried until I got to Wisconsin. I'm born and raised in New Jersey, and I had never knew what a cheese curd was. And I landed in Madison, Wisconsin, and it opened my eyes to an amazing group of food.
Right. And what was your favorite study space here?
Either Memorial Library or, oops, sorry, one sec. Either, I would say either Memorial Library or Granger. But Memorial Library stacks, they're a little creepy, but they were always really quiet.
Yeah. And I mean, you just mentioned, well, I'm actually from Massachusetts, so I went from Massachusetts over here to Madison. What do you like about like the Midwest in Wisconsin versus your hometown, you know?
A lot of things, but I think the people. And Madison's a unique place because it's a consortium and group of very eclectic people from all over the world, not just the United States, but the people who are local to Madison and to Wisconsin are really amazing, amazing people. And Madison is a really special place because it's a meeting ground for all of those types of people. Everybody that I interacted with in Madison was searching and looking and wanting something more, which was a point of attraction to the place. Like it's in the middle of two lakes, and it's this meeting ground of hungry and ambitious people, and it's infectious, and you feel the energy, and it may be 0 degrees Fahrenheit out, but there's this warmth and buzz that exists in Madison at all times. And I think it's because of that. And I think UW breeds that in the people it attracts, and ultimately that permeates through to Madison. That's, what I felt.
Right. And as we wrap this up, is there any final remarks that you'd like to say to our viewers?
Yeah, I think that if you're contemplating starting a business, while I'm hesitant to give advice because the things I share are my story, what worked, what didn't, but if I had to boil down to any type of advice, it's just do it. Just get into it and do it. It's easy to build business models and business plans on a spreadsheet, but you can't simulate rain and wind and different types of challenges that you're going to face, adversity. But by doing it, you're going to adapt and pivot and keep clawing your way to a better, to a higher ground. So don't ever, ever be discouraged by the challenges that are coming. Be nimble, be flexible, pivot, but just get going. That's my advice.
All right, thank you so much for giving us your time, and it's been great to have you on the podcast. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it, and go Badgers.
And that's it for today's episode of The Foundry. We hope you feel motivated to forge your path in shaping your own entrepreneurial journey. If you enjoyed this conversation, make sure to follow the podcast and share it with a friend. And we'll be back soon with more stories from founders, leaders, and those driving change at UW-Madison and beyond. I'm Ben Yang, and you've been listening to the Transcends podcast, The Foundry.